All the Rage with John Bowd on www.tracksfm.org.
Welcome, John Bowd's All the Rage live. We're live again this week. How are you doing? It's a bit nippy here in London for April, but you know, the weather hasn't been right for about 10 years, I reckon, if you think back on it. How are you doing? Lots going on. We haven't really tabled an agenda today. Lately, me and John, there's so much going on, especially in the world of work and foreign policy, in inverted commas. Me and John sort of just drift off to everything and anything, including hip-hop and films, actually. I suppose... I say the word Middle East conflict. It's important we recognise, you know, in school we were taught about World War One, World War Two, and you know, this whole World War One, World War Two, and don't get me wrong, are people that fought in those wars very brave and they sacrificed. But it's important to recognise that we have World War Three at the moment. Well, we have Pakistan, Iran, Syria, Palestine, Israel, Afghanistan, Libya. They're all shooting missiles at each other and killing innocent people, which is what wars do. So I've just named several countries that are attacking each other. This is World War III. They're just not saying it. And there is, I think, unlawful intervention by this country. And that's the narrative. We are in World War III. And the only reason they're just... So you've got to remember World War II, just before World War II, and then maybe just after World War I, the BBC was created because it was a war reporting machine. That's what it was created. It's odd that, because the BBC ain't reporting on World War III. But there you go. John, you ready?
I am ready. I was ready, but you've now given me new things to talk about in your introduction, as you always do. Oh, we should do a show on that. Firstly, what I would say is, if anyone thinks the state of affairs in the world we are living in today that you've just run down is a terrible thing, don't do that dismissive thing of going, well, that's those types of people in their part of the world, because that's simply not the case. US and British interventions in so many ways.
Well, I'm sorry to say, John, the way society is now, certainly in this country, is if the broadband's working, no one's bothered. I'm serious.
Well, that's the other thing I was going to say to you, is it's perfectly possible for a war to take place in other parts of the world and people in little old England being completely insulated from it as if it were nothing. The only other thing I was going to say on that too is, if you do agree that these are terrible state of affairs, probably an idea to stop selling weapons to one side. Unless your argument's going to be, let's sell weapons to both sides. Yeah, that's been done before. But yeah, definitely not a good move, and that's the way that we...
Sorry, John, I forgot to mention Yemen as well, who are absolutely getting battered by Saudi war machines funded by this country. John?
Yes, yeah, so why would they... Oh, isn't it terrible that they are bloodlessly and, with no harm done to people, attacking ships in the name of you know, hijacking ships in the name of stopping the conflict against... people of Gaza. No, actually, it's a great thing that they're doing that. And speaking as in the words of Norman Finkelstein, the child of Holocaust survivors, I wish there'd been Yemenis around for my parents, as he said so brilliantly well. The two things are not even comparable, I'm not going to. So before we start on this week's main issue, I have to ask, Dave, how did you celebrate St. George's Day yesterday?
I was laughing at other people's memes. Just, that's pretty much it, John. Oh, I had a hot cross bun. Is that a St. George's thing, hot cross buns?
Yeah, it was St. George's Day. St. George's Day yesterday, which, lest we all remember, lest we forget, was never, ever celebrated in this country until a bunch of knuckle draggers decided that they thought it was being taken away from us. So now they go on about it all the time. Nobody celebrates St. George's Day, folks. One person who did have a really interesting suggestion about St. George's Day was the last leader of the Labour Party, who suggested it should be a bank holiday. And all of the business and power in this country scoffed at the idea of giving us plebs another bank holiday. And all of the knuckle draggers had fuck all to say about the subject.
No, because I keep saying it again, they're too busy getting their two or three geezers with their little placards and joining NHS strikers, for example, and going on about you, Les. That's it. That's their thing for life, John. That's their proud moment. Let them enjoy it.
Yes. Yeah. Banging on about you, Les, and having violent hate wanks over all of the hot looking young lefty girls that we have on our side now. So, anyway, this week's main story, work is making us sick. So to begin with, we are going to discuss the increase in ill health among workers in Britain. And Dave and myself also have some first-hand experience of this too. But I will start with a little help from a BBC article that was on their website last week, which brought up some of these points I thought were interesting. And I'll quote from it and I'll add my own. This is, by the way, BBC News site Nick Triggle on the 20th of April. And this article describes an epidemic, in his words, of illness among the working age population. Research by the Health Foundation shows that there are many people aged between 16 to 24 in work whose health limits their activity. The number that I saw within this article was 3.7 million people. Overall, here's a quote. Overall, it estimates nearly a fifth of the working age population in the UK, it being the research done by the Health Foundation. The working age population in the UK, when it calls what it calls a work-limiting condition. In fact, the think tank believes the problem has become so bad that it is threatening the economic potential of the country, end of quote. This comes a week after the Office of National Statistics warned that numbers are growing for people forced out of the workplace and wider jobs market by ill health. This has increased by 1.4 million over the last 10 years. So it's not just a pandemic-related thing. Post-pandemic, 470,000 more people are out of the workforce on ill health grounds, while many more continue to work despite long-term health problems. The Office for Budget Responsibility has highlighted the mounting economic cost of these post-pandemic trends, and the government has recently announced a proposal designed to address the UK's inactivity problem. They seem pretty inactive about setting a date for a general election while we're on the subject, among other things. In fact, this government seemed pretty inactive about tackling the healthcare problems in this country, the welfare problems, i.e. it not being high enough and people needing more, the lack of food security, the lack of housing, the lack of jobs that actually pay you a living wage. I could go on. Mental health conditions such as depression and anxiety are now most common and particularly acute among the young. So, the big question is, why are working-age people so unwell? Christopher Rocks, that is genuinely his name, and that is such a fucking cool name. Christopher Rocks from the Health Foundation notes the impact of the 2008 financial crisis, which those of us here at All the Rage maintain capitalism has never actually recovered from. He says, quote, "We saw an economic downturn and public spending cuts that had an impact on people's health in many different ways. The pandemic and subsequent cost of living crisis exacerbated trends, but the signs were there before COVID hit. Access to healthcare has become more difficult, while those fundamental building blocks of health, such as good housing and adequate incomes, are under strain." End of quote. Blimey, it's almost like he said everything I just said. Clearly I'm a genius. I didn't do any research for that, and he did. Further, the effects of all this depends on age and where people live. You've heard of the postcode lottery, I'm sure. And while they might necessarily call it that in other parts of the world, I'm sure other countries have similar, if not, you know, exactly the same thing. Research published by the Health Foundation on predicted health inequalities by 2040 warns the numbers of people with major illnesses is set to increase significantly. With, quote, "with the people in the most deprived areas suffering the most, many with multiple conditions," end of quote. So that's another aspect we have to think about. It's not just somebody being unwell with one condition now. Literally, there are multiples. It goes on to say, this research goes on to say, quote, on current trends, inequalities in health will persist over the next two decades. People in the 10% most deprived areas can expect to be diagnosed with major illnesses, with major illness a decade earlier than people in the 10% least deprived areas. End of. Chronic pain is suffered mostly unseen, but this is the kind of condition that makes all life difficult to impossible. This is something people in these organisations and charities have been warning about for years. This makes life all but difficult to impossible, from working to socialising. This is something that can become more prominent within our ageing working population, increasing difficulty in getting the healthcare that they need and increasing difficulty in the ability to retire when they should do. Now, a further report from the Resolution Foundation that came out the previous February found, in their words, more than a third of 18 to 24-year-olds are reporting symptoms of mental illness. The report also found young people were now more likely to experience a mental health problem than any other age group, which is, it turns out, a complete reversal of the situation two decades ago when they were the least likely to. But we must ask if all of this is down to the greater ability to discuss such issues and that previously would not have been so open. It is very important to be fair and balanced about this. We do have to ask, is there more mental health problems today? I mean, I believe there is, and I believe there's the ground for doing so, but we also have to, we can't dismiss the fact that it might also be that people are just more willing and able to talk about them now. So in response to that, Dr. Shari McDade of the Mental Health Foundation is quoted by the BBC in their article and says the following. No doubt that is a factor in the figures that are being reported, but we cannot underestimate the impact the past few years have had. The young people of today were the toddlers and infants of the 2008 financial crash. End of quote. Plus, they have lived through conflicts such as Brexit, followed by the pandemic, which was also difficult for school kids, many of whom will now be entering the working world and would have had a very fractured education in a lot of ways, or even for folks who were going from primary to secondary, perhaps their first couple of years. There's something on the BBC News about this evening, actually, just as we looked at just before we came live, about people who had, or kids who had transitioned into secondary school in basically doing it at home online and got used to that, and then they're having to go back to school with all of the noise and the awful swanky school buildings that all these places have now that look somewhere between an office and a prison and this sort of thing, and this is kind of jarring. And what's the result of that? Well, another thing as a result of that can just be that it messes with your ability to get educated. Anyway, these are their formative years, of course, followed by what is at its best really should be the beginning of a sense of freedom upon entering the working world. Instead, they got work that does not pay and a cost of living crisis to deal with. I've said it before and I'll say it again. I would not be young today. It was bad enough when I was young and it's even worse today. It's funny, isn't it? A lot of people seem to have a problem admitting that, you know, younger generations have a worse time than them. I have no problem admitting it whatsoever. The young people do extraordinarily well considering how utterly fucked over they've been by this system, and not least this country. The doctor also says you cannot ignore the impact of social media, our good friend again, citing the bullying many have experienced and the way it induces body image worries because of the highly idealised way that they are presented. Nearly two-thirds, again, this is from the article on the BBC, nearly two-thirds of adults are overweight or obese, and that, according to Diabetes UK, is translating into an increase in cases of type 2 diabetes. While less common, rises in the under-40s are particularly sharp, according to them, and social deprivation plays a major role in this. Again, we already know this. Rates of type 2 are more than twice as high in the most deprived areas. Income, education, housing, and access to healthy food are all strongly linked to developing the disease, says the charity. And they're not the only ones. There's plenty of research on that one. The Health Foundation's report states it will require a cross-government approach to address the underlying causes of ill health, as well as extra investment in the NHS, councils, and the voluntary sector. Christopher Rocks points out the glaringly obvious here. You need a healthy workforce if you want a healthy economy. You certainly do, Christopher. You rock. All of this should be a surprise to absolutely nobody. We have known about this since austerity started. In fact, this was part of the plan, breaking the working class further than they'd managed to do in the 80s and the 90s to try and finish the job, working us to death while waving the flag. So this requires major action, such as fully funding the health service to tackle the greater need for mental health services and physical services that we've mentioned already, cut hospital waiting lists, all of that usual stuff, you know, paying in to get local councils to be able to do what they need to do in the voluntary sector where they can pick up the slack, although we shouldn't rely on the voluntary sector too much. Plus, increasing economic security for all while you're at it, not least for older folks, so they can actually afford to retire and don't have to work themselves into a grave. Not for this government, of course. They and their funders' big question is, how can we ignore this ill health and push people back into the workplace? Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, still not voted for by the public, announced that what we really have in Britain is a problem with doctors writing people off work when they are sick. Because we all know there's nothing a doctor likes more than to just hand out drugs and notes to sign you off of work. They've really got nothing better to do all day long. If you know any of those doctors, please tell me where I can find them, because mine never do it. So he is proposing to stop doctors actually having the power to do this and hand it over to specialist work professionals who are not doctors. So they do not have the extensive training. Doctors train for around about 6 years. How long does your specialist work professional train? I would like to know. Perhaps as long as the same people they've been using since austerity began in 2010 to assess whether or not somebody is able to work, as if they would know. How many people have died on the registers of that waiting for their necessary benefits to come through, being forced into work that they can't do, and having to make choices between medicine and heat, among other things, and food. The Doctors' Union, the British Medical Association, the BMA, said that fit notes were carefully considered before they are written and criticised Mr Sunak's hostile rhetoric on the issue. Yes, hostile is a good way to put it. He is a nasty little shit, that man, isn't he? He really is very like passive-aggressive, and the passiveness is starting to slip away as he realises just how much he's going to get devastated as when there's an election coming up. It's just what a vile little creature. And just look at the people he put in his cabinet too. What about that's the other thing? No, I tell you what, I'm getting distracted. We'll come back to that. It's an eternal question. Why do political losers still get talked to by the media in this country? I'm looking at Suella Braverman right now. Okay, what do I care what she thinks about anything? She resigned in disgrace after whipping the far right into a riotous frenzy against the police, and on Remembrance Weekend, no less. And this person is now going, oh, so what do you think of the Rwanda plan? I don't care what she thinks of it. The woman's a fascist. I can give a fuck what her opinion is. Okay, post-crisis, we have in truth not seen any kind of real recovery. We have been told about the great revolution of digital technology, for instance, and how this is a future and all of the stuff we've heard in one form or another for the last 20 years. The thing is, the material reality is not altered, even in the gig economy. While you can order your lunch rather than getting up and preparing it yourself or walking to a shop to get it yourself, it still requires labour to make it, just not your labour. This labour is creating a physical item, a material entity, which is then dispatched and delivered, all of which involves labour, i.e. it involves a workforce. This is part of why it is so vital for gig workers to organise and get paid better. Right now, they work in the worst conditions, but the industry is not going anywhere. So for the sake of everything from mental health to the ability to get a mortgage, terms and conditions need to improve in all of this work immediately. And the only way to improve your terms and conditions is to have a trade union. What we do see, sadly, is a horrible judgmental position, mostly taken by liberals as much as conservatives, that workers in gig and service jobs do not deserve to be well paid. Specifically, they seem to hate fast food workers, finding the idea of them making a living wage or even more than that an insult to their world beliefs. Fast food workers should somehow work on the bottom of the most bottom rung and should be trodden underfoot and never make a decent living in order to persuade them to want to work somewhere else. Whatever. It's a really deeply fucked up way of looking at the world. But hey, that's our leaders, folks. That's our commentators, who are definitely not leaders. During one of the McDonald's workers' drives years ago for a living wage, boomers and other capitalist dickheads were posting pictures of the ordering machines in McDonald's branches, stating that this was the future. So how do you expect to get a better wage, better pay, etc.? Why not just give up now? Half a decade or so later, find me the McDonald's that has no staff serving in it. Who cooks and serves the food? Just because you walk up to a machine and press buttons and get filmed while doing it, doesn't, and collects data from you, doesn't mean that there is now no more need for a human workforce. Oh, well, the robots will do it. When? Robot's not going to make you a hamburger. Okay, it'll break it, for one thing. Amazon Fresh, the supermarket arm of Jeff Bezos's, well, what would you call it? Empire, I suppose. An empire with all of the democracy you would associate with such a thing. That now has a shop in Camden, where you go in, you swipe your phone or whatever, swipe your watch or some other crappy device that you don't need in life, and pick up what you want. And you get charged for it later on your account. So you kind of walk in, scan, hi, it's me, pick up whatever you want to. It makes a note of everything you've picked up and you scan it, and then it just charged you for it. Last time I passed it, and every time I've passed it since, because I pass the one in Camden on a regular basis, there were at least 6 security personnel in there. Right. Why are they not manning tills? So basically, you've taken the same amount of staff you would. Actually, in a shop this size, you'd probably have less than 6 staff. You'd probably have 4 at the most, because it's quite small. But let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Let's say 6. You have the same amount of staff you would have actually manning the store and learning skills. And more importantly, doing that job. Because this is a personal bugbear of mine, has been for a long time. If I go to the supermarket tonight, so I've been to work today. Right? If I go to the supermarket tonight, if I go to these self-serving tills, I'm scanning my own stuff, I'm weighing my own fruit and finding it on a machine, blah, 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 and then I'm paying them. So I'm doing a job, okay? It is still a job, because if you go there, you see folks on the tills, right? They're still doing the job. I'm doing a job, and I'm paying them for the privilege of doing the job. I deeply hate this so much, so much. Anyway, Amazon Fresh. Nothing has fundamentally changed to the material reality here. Okay, it's just appearance. It's simple as that. It's they could be manning the tills. Instead, they're working the security. Why are they working security? To check you don't slip anything in your pocket. Well, so you can do that on the staff who work the tills used to do that with the cameras, or another member of staff does it. It's just a way of cutting a workforce, which of course is the only thing they ever really want to do, because it saves them money. Other than that, all we can say here to everyone, young and old, poor and better off, is hang on in there. Get organised and demand better, and we will be with you all of the way. It's very, very easy for me to sit here and tell people to not give up. All I can say to you is that I mean every word of it from the bottom of whatever cold, blackened thing stands for my heart these days. But I do. I mean it. It's not easy, but hang in there. You never know. We have had to exercise phenomenal amounts of patience within the working world, and we will continue to have to do so going forward. But it will be rewarded, because we are the people and we can't be stopped. As someone who's been a long time, well, not that long, but over a decade, supporter of the Palestinian people in an active way, it really is heartening to see. It's terrible to see what sport is about, but it's heartening to see people from here to America, especially America, and throughout Germany, when they're facing serious suppression, to stand up, fight back, and say, we demand peace for the people of Palestine. We demand the land of Palestine back to the Palestinian people. It is very, very heartwarming. And you never know. If you come to me 10 years ago and said that would happen, I would say, well, not looking at what we're seeing today, it would. So, anyway, tied a long tail onto the end of that story. Dave, work is making us sick, mental health increases, etc. What's your take?
Well, just on... So I've got to put my RB brain on how I can link your favourite people to the current problems we have in the 21st century. But firstly, solidarity to the workers at Amazon Coventry. Fingers crossed that they issue with a certificate to be the official trade union of that depot in Amazon, and that will spread. And you'll probably find the Amazon workers in Coventry will be on a better rate of pay and better terms and conditions than the rest of the country. So I would say to all Amazon depots, step up. Secondly, so I'm thinking off the cuff here of, let's say I'm 58, so I'm going to take the view of a 58-year-old person that is probably John's favourite person, where people ridicule mental health and say, you know, pull yourself together. It wasn't like that in my day. I won't do the dialect, John, because it drives you nuts. So, okay, point taken. So we celebrate Poppy's Day, for example, and we're very protective of that, and we're afraid that people are going to take that away from us. So we go to World War One. World War One is typical of mental health. So this is back in the day, as the day as you can be, and these are all the things that we celebrate and protect. Absolutely. So World War One was a typical example of mental health, in that we had, after the world, that war, which was a terrible war, by the way, the amount of people that were left homeless afterwards when they came back because they never didn't have a home, and they were suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. So you would have seen a lot of people living on the streets, mainly after that war. And some of them would talk to themselves and things like that, and we'd say, oh, they're mad, you know. No, that's after a terrible war. So it says back in the day, and pull yourself together as you can get, World War One. Then we get to World War Two, which was even a worse war, and the stress it caused. Just after World War Two, they banned conscription, national service, if you remember. Now, if you think, well, they're banning national service because they said, well, war is futile and it's a nice thing to do. Incorrect. What happened, the society, or certainly the establishment, had a backlash from men coming back from World War Two and said, my kids ain't going to fight in any war. And they were adamant their kids aren't doing national service. So they banned it. It wasn't because they were being nice. People came back from World War Two, as back in the day as you can think. Weren't like that in my day, you know what I mean? Look at me, do Lambada. Sorry, there was mental health there.
He couldn't resist.
And parents said, my kids ain't fighting. And what happened was, with those blokes, politics and society and the establishment and unions got together and said, let's not have homeless people after World War One. Let's build council houses. And they did that after World War Two to avoid the homelessness from World War One. That's as back in the day as you can get, right? And then what they did is, which is the worst thing, they started creating army social clubs, which are still prevalent in societies today, and created a huge amount of alcohol abuse on cheap drink. This is as back in the day as you can think, 50s, 60s and 70s. So back in the day, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? Back in the day, my dad used to... No, it was alcohol abuse.
My dad used to go down the Legion, come home, beat my mum up, piss on me and go to bed. Those are beautiful days. I'm telling you, beautiful days. You don't know anything about like it. Wonderful.
So this is just manifested. So it's not a liberal thing, mental health. It's been going and back in the day. And society sometimes did things to stop things that it tried to learn from. But the trouble with war is it creates so much mental health issues. And those two world wars did. We are now seeing, after the Afghanistan-Iraq illegal war, more homeless people, because there's no social housing anymore. Not like the good old days, you know what I mean? Knock it on the head. You don't get that anymore. And 44% of the population now are suffering from mental health. And if you say these people, there was no such thing as mental health in my day. Absolutely, yeah, they were on the street after World War One and World War Two. 2 days that we celebrate by buying poppies for. Because we called those people mad, didn't we? Oh, there's that mad bloke. No, he's come back from war and he hasn't got a home and he talks to himself because he's seen people blown up. So, can we stop saying back in the day, pull yourself together? It just didn't, it's not like that. It wasn't like that. And society and unions and politics, what both sides of the aisle, by the way, got together and said, how can we avoid the things that we did in the First World War? But I don't think we learn. I can't see anything plucking something out of the air like social housing and assisting people struggling with mental health. We've just recognised it, that's all. All we've done is recognised it, right? But it was recognised, right, after 1917. It's just that we're calling it mental health now. So this is as back in the day as you can. I'll just pluck that out of the air, that bit of knowledge, John. But so can we just address that? And where is this? So as I said, after 1945 and 1944, where we created the NHS, we're not Maggie Thatcher bashing here. I'm just saying society can, when it gets its head together, can do stuff. Sometimes it does things deliberately, like I just mentioned, the men's social clubs were created, where people suffer from alcohol abuse because they deliberately allow cheap, subsidised alcohol in those premises. And that's where we got a lot of alcohol abuse, and that led to a lot of domestic abuse. You used to hear in the pub, I gave her a right-hander, you know, because that's how we are back in the day, you know. Knock it on here, do the Lombard, I gave her a right-hander. Yeah, those days. John?
Can't resist, can you? You just automatically steer into that. I know. I'm the same. I'm exactly the same. Yeah, you see, I don't wish to start any kind of generational conflict, so I genuinely don't. I don't subscribe to that. Last time David Rosenberg was on this show, shout out to a one true comrade. He did some very interesting points about not, you know, making this about generational difference. But at the same time, you can't ignore the fact of our ages and the ages of some of the older than us. And when people talk about this, we never had it in my day. Okay, well, let me tell you what you had in your day. You had the post-war consensus, which meant you had generations of people dedicated to us not having any more conflict because they just seen what it had done to the world and they had realized how truly awful it was. They were not celebrating war. They were not stapling a fucking flag to it and waving at every opportunity. They weren't running around telling everybody they'd personally won the war all by themselves. They saw the true horror of what had happened here, and they wished to prevent that happening. And overall, they wished to create a better world for their kids and people coming after them. I am not buying into any of this greatest generation bollocks. Okay, I hate that. I really do.
Doesn't exist.
There's no such thing as one great generation.
There's no great generation.
People are better than others.
There's no great generation. It's horrible.
They did what they had to do. Yeah. Okay, they're not better than you, and I'm not better than you, and you're not better than me. Okay, that's not how. That's just not the way it is. Seems so simplistic and pathetic to have to say this really out loud, as in an adult world, but apparently it seems necessary. So, let's as I said, the post-war consensus. You had the post-war consensus. You had the welfare state. You had extremely strong trade unionism, and you had masses and masses of jobs because you had industry, which just produced. It was the time and the place, right? It just produced what people need to act. There was a lot to produce, so they needed a lot of work. So you had a social safety net. You had housing that was affordable. You had council housing if you weren't able to afford it. And I'm talking council housing, not just flats, etc. I mean, nice places. Flats were nice too. I'm sick of council estates being spoken of in a derogatory way. Okay, they're a wonderful invention. If they're allowed to deteriorate, if the people who live there are disrespected to the point that they're thought of as not important enough to even bother tidying up the area that they live in, that's a question for the ruling class that needs to be placed at their door. It's not a question that needs to be thrown at the feet of the people who struggle and strive through life in order to get by. It's disgusting. You have all of that. By the time I was coming up, when I left school just after a recession. An older relative of mine had managed to get an apprenticeship somewhere. I couldn't find an apprenticeship for love or money. I came out of school barely competent, as I'm sure you wouldn't be able to tell from listening to this show week after week. I was not able to get my shit together in a lot of ways, and I had a lot of problems. I had a lot of unemployment. I had sporadic employment, unemployment, bad pay, non-existent pay, etc., etc. Took me a while to get it all together and to find something. I would still say I'll be, as I said already once this evening, I'll put my hand up and say, young people have it harder than I did right now. They do. They have it much harder. It's not difficult to admit that. It's not difficult to admit it because it was the truth. Because at least when I did have a job, I actually had a structure to that job. Okay, we had boring and underpaid work versus my, you know, soul destroying or bodily destroying in some cases, it seems, and not even paying work, which is basically just helps you sink money into the pockets of the bastard who owns the leaky flat that you're residing in at that time.
Oh, we lost John temporarily. As John said, there was a time, certainly when myself and John were growing up, that you could leave school on a Friday in London. And
okay. I am.
Sorry, completely... John. You cut out for about a minute.
Oh, okay. I don't know whatever else I was saying. Okay, I'll just jump back to the last thing I was saying. So all I was saying was, if there are people suffer from mental illnesses and mental conditions that you don't understand, I don't care. Okay, no one's asking your opinion. We're concerned for the person in question here. I don't know if pathologically is the right word, but I'm going to use it anyway because it always sounds posh. I am pathologically incapable of suffering from loneliness, right? I genuinely cannot wait to get as far away from people the majority of the time. That's just the way that I am.
Oh.
What that does not result in, I know, believe it or not, can you believe it? What that doesn't result in, however, is me thinking that anyone who does suffer from loneliness, a very, very serious condition the world over, a condition that in parts of Asia, for instance, like Japan, they actually have a minister in charge of dealing with loneliness. It's so severe. And it's something that's becoming increasingly an issue in this part of the world, particularly with the digitalization. You know, we're even suggesting now that those old people who have had the temerity to keep living past their useful date. And, we can't just keep employing people to take care of them. Let's put a robot in there to talk to them, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? It's just the idea that loneliness wouldn't exist because I don't feel it is absolutely ridiculous to me, utterly ridiculous. Just get your head around the fact that people have different places and feelings and experiences to you. It's really not that hard. Sorry, Dave, you were going to say something.
Oh, you just said about old people that are living longer. No, I tell you something, John. I know I joke about the knock it on the head, do the lambadas. When it comes to a dispute, those guys, and they're not much around, I must admit, but those guys are great in organising and fighting for workers' rights the day and during the dispute. They're finishing now, and it's really unfortunate. Because it's hard for me to get a 21-year-old to fight for the things that me, myself and you know. So we're dealing with people that doesn't know about 9/11 or, you know, the financial crisis, Gen X and Gen Z, you know, or don't, even elections, even posting a letter, you know, because everything's all email. And these guys, my age, the 50 pluses, they're great at organising and fighting for their rights. You know, you just let them run.
Oh, yeah.
They will really explain to people, you know, young kids and that, why they're striking and how the benefits of it is. And they'll organise and they're great. It's just if we could bottle that in some of their arguments, things like Brexit and ULEZ and housing and mental health and loneliness is a big thing, especially during the pandemic. You know, people thought we were making
Indeed.
It up. That really highlighted it, how important social contact is. You know,
I agree. And again, I mean, the reference I'm making to people living past their usefulness was a rather snide reference I was making to that Matthew Paris article from a couple of weeks ago, which at the time I said is someone who's totally dismissible, of course. But yeah, I mean, that he basically, well, the only thing of interest in that article was that he said the quiet part out loud, which was capitalism.
How old is Matthew Paris? How old is he?
How, How old is he? Well, he's, I don't know, he's probably older than you, but then he's also insulated because he's a columnist, which is a job that has absolutely zero worth or meaning.
Look, apart from me and you, who probably we do things for free on articles, and yeah, that's why we're here, we're not getting paid for this. But I would question those journalists, you know, who funds them, you know. You know, that's how it is now. If anything we're going to say, well, back in the day, the thing I'd say about journalism, at least back in the day, you had a journalist that went out there and reported what was happening. You demonised Pilger because he went and did it. What you should be doing, getting out there and reporting. I mean, your idea of reporting now is sitting down on a Sunday morning on the BBC, pulling out the papers and say, what do the papers say? That's your idea of, that's your standard of journalism now. It's disgusting. John?
I looked this up the other week, just in case you have any other trouble finding it. But I haven't watched this for a long time, so I need to rewatch it. But no, you're absolutely right. But not only, I mean, while we're on the subject of kicking Matthew Paris while he's down, he should know better himself, because in the 80s, World in Action challenged him to go and live on benefits for a month, and he took the challenge. And part of the impact with this was that he wasn't really able in good conscience to practice at the time. I'm pretty sure this was how it went down. As I say, it's on YouTube, so you can find it. Just type in World in Action. Well, firstly, type in World in Action. It's well worth watching. Type World in Action, Matthew Paris, and you'll find the one where, yeah, they sent him to a deprived area to try and get by for a month. And he did not succeed, if I remember rightly. And I don't think he was really able to carry out those policies after that. Not that it seems to have changed him fundamentally, because he's still Tory scum, but nevertheless, it's something that he was willing to do.
I would say to kids now, and I know we go out and podcasts all over the world, if you listen to these kids, when these people come on and give this... So I'm telling you now, if you're listening to us, myself and John are not getting paid to do this show. And we do a lot of vocational stuff full-time. On a company wage, but these people that come on TV and tell you that this is what they think, and things that aren't, they say things that aren't happening in your community. Ask yourself, are you on this forum for free, like Dave and John are? Right, me and John will show you our bank account. Just to prove.
Yeah, look at my bank account, cheeky bastards.
But these people come on and they don't, I don't know what their designation is. Who are they funded by? You know, because if it is the mainstream media or some economic think tank, and these think tanks, John, they go out as a charity. So that means they don't have to disclose their financial information. Right, and a big think tank is currently in charge of the country at the moment, and it's listed as a charity. Ask yourself, kids, ask the questions. Don't leave it to us old people. John?
Yes, indeed. Ask yourself is always a good policy, I think, generally speaking. I really do wish I just didn't sound like such an old git, you know, handing out advice to people. I really wish I could make all of this more entertaining, but I'm not. Sorry, folks, I'm not the entertaining type. I listen to a lot of podcasts. You think I would learn from it, but the only thing I've learned from it is I'm not very good at it. So basically, I'm just going to lay out the things as they are and fill in where I think of a particular voice on a subject hasn't been heard, a particular view or a take on something. You know, we're all looking for a take, right? So that's kind of what I do. Don't do it as entertainingly as I could, but hey, maybe we'll get there in the end. But I think we've covered that. You know, there is a crisis in healthcare in this country, but it is a manufactured crisis. It is government-made crisis, government after government from 2010s onwards, if not beforehand. And they're doing it because they want to privatise these things. This is, in certain ways, I will say this much, you know, the application of capitalism is pretty much the same all over the world, but in certain ways, this is a uniquely horrible country to live in and to get through. It has a certain degree of material benefit, which makes it easier than other parts of the world. And from my perspective, it's easier to deal with because it's cold most of the time, which I prefer.
But John, what would you say to someone? Because I know you go on and you do some great work and fair play to you, especially for the ethnic minorities in this country, John. Thank you.
I am the white savior. You're quite
good. Well, you know what I've called you off, but I'm not going to do it online on here. But what would you say to people that say, well, if you don't like it here, don't live here? I mean, that's a common thing, isn't it?
So what would I say? That's such an interesting question. What would I say to someone who said that? Well, normally I'd say, okay, that's a really grown-up debating point. Clearly you're worth about as much as what's on the bottom of my shoe right now. I'm not going to bother talking to you because I think it's a bit childish and silly. But and it depends what kind of mood I'm in. Okay, let's take it from another perspective. My position, and you can call this whatever you want, is this is the reality of where we live, right? And right now, you and I, we live in this country. And what do we do? Well, as trade union reps and as everything that involves in the workplace and wider and outside of the workplace, that involves trying to make this world a better place, this country a better place. I'm not dividing it into countries. What I'm saying is this is in the immediate, right? We're interested in the world being a better place, but the most immediate that is in front of us is the country. So that's what we're interested in. Okay, so as long as that's understood. What's the most prominent thing in most people's lives right now? That's work. Most people have to work in order to get by. So we're trying to improve things in the workplace. We support people in our own workplace directly. We support other people unionizing. You shouted out the Amazon workers in Coventry, for instance. We've been covering that a lot on this show. We support and actively do things in order to try and make that a reality. We actively do things to try and relieve the suffering of the homeless, not least to get them indoors. Okay, we're not going out there in the streets to give them a cup of tea every week. So it makes us feel better. And if you are, that's the wrong reason for doing it. We go in there because we think that homelessness is an indignity and an obscenity, especially in a country that is as rich as this one. All of these sort of things. What we're trying to do is improve things. For all the people who say, if you don't like this place exactly the way it is now, why don't you leave? Well, firstly, why would I want to go abroad anywhere? As you can see from our weapons sales, as we mentioned this evening, from Yemen through to Palestine, who'd want to be a victim of Britain's foreign policy? Secondly, I just don't buy into this kind of notion of everything should, no matter how bad it is, nothing should ever be done to try and change things or to make it the same. The desperate middle class need for security is something that far too many of us have sacrificed our well-being for, whether we wanted to or not. It's not like we were ever asked. And I just don't believe that it is acceptable to carry on with that way of life. I think it's deplorable. I'm not here to make the comfortable feel better. And I suppose if I was being decent to people like that, I'd ask them what it is that they want. Because if they want a country where everything is, you know, where the government... If they want a country where the truth about the state of the country is not told, where the media is an arm of government, where it is controlled to say, shut up and be happy, this country is brilliant, don't ever say anything against it, no matter what the material reality is, I think maybe they're the ones that should go and live in North Korea, not me. So that would, broadly speaking, be my response. Or if if I was in the wrong mood, I'd just laugh in your face and tell you to piss off. All options are available. You know, it's always been kind of a strange question to me. Because it does come back without being like, you know, 15-year-old philosopher wannabe in school. You know, why does anybody do anything? So if someone says, well, why are you trying to change these things? Why don't you just leave? Why? Why are you happy, stewing in your own shit? Which is my perspective, perception of the way that you live. You might not agree with me, but that's my perception of it. I don't really understand. And as for the need to change, as for the inevitability of having to deal with that, I refer you back to James Baldwin and that wonderful speech of his that's on YouTube, It is not I that am telling you this. Time is telling you this. Change or die. So I hope that answers your question to some degree, Dave.
No, I think if we're going to be nostalgic, I think things that we've achieved in this country, like the NHS, general elections in the main, apart from the last 10 years, but previous before that, we need people asking the questions. We need people getting onto the street and protesting. And regardless of the media not covering those protests, we need people asking the questions. And those people asking the questions have changed policy, politics, policy, NHS, social housing, support for mental health, because in the 21st century, we're going to have to get our heads around it. Mental health issues are massive. We're talking 44% of the current sick rate in the UK. It's even larger in the US. We have to get our heads around it. It's like heart attacks now, you know. Both are unfortunate, but both are an illness. Stress is huge, and I'm not a no doctor, John. I wouldn't profess to be one. Stress is a big cause of cancer, you know. And you hear about it in friends and family now, you know, more and more and more. And we have to get our heads around it. I don't agree with charities such as Cancer Investigation. I mean, I do donate every week, and I have done for 30 years. But I think we should have a public-funded investigation and science and all that good stuff. But I think they'll probably end up fine saying, well, we have to relieve stress. And unfortunately, in the world of work, John, for example, and the cost of living crisis, and we go back round again, John, it's a huge, huge problem, you know, for all the things, you know. And it's, people just probably listen to me and you go, they're going to just bash Thatcher. Yeah, we can do that. But we are where we are, right? And as I said, all this good stuff that we fought for, you know, NHS and social housing and all that good stuff, where is it coming from next? That's the question. In history, if we look at all the stuff I mentioned and John's mentioned, what's the next thing, politically and socially, that we come up with something? You know, that's the question. You know, if you look at our history that I just mentioned, what we did for World War One, World War Two, conscription, what NHS, you know, workers doing jobs that no one else wants to do, the indigenous population. We solved that in the 50s and 60s. What's the next thing then, John?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really important point you've said there. You know, what worth is your nostalgia, particularly for a time that you didn't live through? But what worth is it if what you're basically going to do is deny and shut down and sneer at absolutely anything that tries to make life better now? What you're saying, I mean, what does it actually amount to? Think about this in a practical sense for a second. Our life was so much better in the past. Okay, well, I don't believe that, but let's just take that on the surface. Okay, you give me that life was better in the past. What am I supposed to do with that? What am I supposed to do? Is to say, oh, okay, well, things just aren't good like they used to be. Okay. So what am I, do I drink myself to death out of depression and sadness? Should I be sitting in here on YouTube watching, you know, old films, television programs, which I do sometimes, but really could I get something out of them for today, not for yesterday? Or why don't you try doing something useful with your nostalgia, like turning it into power for the present so that we can take back the possibility of a future? Yeah, I mean, you people are big in about taking things back, take back control, take back our country. Okay, why don't you take back the future? Why don't we all take back the future? because it's been taken away from us, not least since the end of the Soviet Union and the belief that the capitalist West was completely perfect and the ultimate power base, and nobody could want anything more than this. Never mind the massive amount of state apparatus that was used to break the working class and its organizational abilities in order to get to that position in the first place. You know, the rich keep getting ludicrously richer while the rest of us keep getting ludicrously, dangerously, frighteningly poorer. And that's why you're seeing an increase in sickness, like as Dave points out, like stress, which can cause you cancer, which, you know, and mental ill health and all this kind of stuff, which again means you end up relying far more on a system that is already creaking, beyond creaking under the weight of everything that people are relying on it for. What is your problem with the idea of a future? That's what I would say. So I would say to all the nostalgists. And at some point or another, we'll get into my joke about it, but my genuine belief that this country is basically locked in a form of cultural fascism, and that the epitome of that is Heart FM. It is just this idea that nothing can ever get better. It really is truly intolerant and intolerable from my perspective. I just think it's weird. It's just always just such a weird argument. You ever had that? I mean, just think about it, Dave. Next time someone's going on at you about, you know, I mean, it's in a genuine sense. You don't have to answer immediately. Go away and think about it. But when somebody is laying it out with you, oh, this was better, that was better, this was better, that was better. Okay, what do you want me to do with that? What? How do you want me to respond? What do you expect me to think around that? What fucking use is that to me? For you to tell me everything used to be better? Yeah, I used to have more energy when I was younger. And what? Do you expect me to sit here and cry about it? Or do you expect me to go, actually, okay, well, I can't run 3 times a week like I used to. I could still probably run twice a week, though. I'm going to go running twice a week. And it's just, anyway. I did want to go in. Actually, I think, I'm glad this story's taken us all the way through. I was going to talk about culture war not being a vote winner, but I'm actually going to bump that story to next week, because I think that'll be a good way to start next week, actually.
Okay, kind of building on what that's a whole about. Different, that is a whole different show, isn't it, John?
Culture. And it is. I mean, basically, all it was is that there was... Okay, I'll sum it up quickly because we've got 5 minutes. There was research done by the organisation More in Common that found that culture war tactics are not a vote winner for swing voters, right? Many of the participants were shown sort of messages from Tory ad campaigns like the woke mob is taking over, and they just dismissed it quite rightly as, well, that's just desperate. That's an attempt to distract us from their record in government, et cetera, et cetera. And what you're talking about here is folks who were, they're not Labour voters per se, they're not Tory voters per se, they're people who have voted for either side or whatever else in other ways. They're like, they are floating voters. And what they found was, like, you know, when the Tories lent on sort of the anti-woke stuff, they saw a 10% point decrease in people saying that they were likely to vote for Sunak in a general election. For instance, what they were more specific issues they found to be more popular. And then this includes stuff when, like, issues in regards tackling Britain's history of colonialism and paying back for it. Not a particularly popular issue among these people. But what they did find that was popular is interesting, is creating jobs in the local area, tackling antisocial behaviour, whatever that means, saving the high street. There's a big one. You know, this was something that was really getting people's attention. When people were seeing proposals around stuff like that, they were in favour of it. The Labour crowd saw a rise in points of people willing to vote for them when they saw issues saying, 6 points in fact, promising to protect the NHS. Whatever that means is another example, especially from West Streeting, but nevertheless. They were also, they saw one person, I thought this is an interesting quote, but somebody said that they felt Sunak was playing to the crowd on anti-trans issues. So, long story short, we've kind of covered it now. Long story short was that folks said that they were not interested in this culture war stuff. They were interested in reality. Okay? Stuff that faces them directly. So it's not a vote winner. It's not even a vote winner. The problem is that too much time. There is actually something I said at the end here. I've got to quote this because I just laughed when I read this. Hang on, where are we? Is here. Oh, yes. The research noted that knowledge of the culture war was highest among progressive activists who took part in online debates and were highly politically engaged. Among all other vote segments, only 1 in 5 people could actually explain what a culture war is. something we always said about being on social media too much. It's not fucking real. Okay, this is, most people don't know what they're on about. I'm looking at Twitter right now. I said this to Dave just before we started. I'm looking at Twitter right now. It's Tommy Robinson, pint-sized loser. That's got to be him. The IDF, you know, etc. Spotify. This is just the shit that people are talking about on here because they have nothing better to do. It's not happening in the real world, etc., etc. Anyway, sorry. I will go into more detail about that next week. We'll pick up that because we haven't got time to discuss it now. But that's basically summing it up. It is, you know, no one gives a shit about your silly little culture wars. So just cut them out because you're only pleasing yourself. Again, you spend all your time with this culture war, you know, pouring your sadness down your throat and talking about, you know, non-binaries with purple hair. Well, they've always been here. They're always going to be here. I will fight to the death to defend them. And you don't want to see me fighting to the death. And the fact of the matter is, you know, this is an argument you've lost before you've started. And there's no fucking argument here anyway. Why are you grinding your gears on something like this? I'd suggest it's probably because you're stressed out and maybe your work life isn't what it should be and you're worried about your bills and you're worried about the cost of living and you're worried about the future for your children and grandchildren who don't fucking have one at the moment. And you should be worried about that. So get in the game. We end so many shows like this now, Dave. You know, me telling these people, stop moaning, stop complaining, stand with us. Listen, we've done the majority of the work for doing this anyway, so you can just come in and join us on the march or whatever. It's not a big deal. I'm not going to hold that against you. But, you know, get in the game and stop. You know, you're worth more than this, and so are the people around you, okay? And nobody in here doesn't have a right to be here. If people are coming here on boats, that's because they're desperate. Recognise their desperation. In fact, if anyone's coming to Britain, it's because they're desperate. God knows no one would really want to be in their right mind. So you just need to be realistic. And if you want to wave the flag, build something that's worth being proud of. Simple as that. Build a country where people's mental health issues are taken seriously and they're provided with what they need to get by in life. Build a country where people have enough money in their pocket to get by when they have a roof over their head, which is non-negotiable. When they have food in their belly, which is non-negotiable. Be proud of a country where, you know, landlords are run out of business and their life is made impossible. That's something to be proud of. There you go. That's my spiel for the patriotic front of the All the Rage crowd.
John, many thanks. And we will be talking culture wars and many more next week. Thank you, John.
We do. So Dave's got some tunes for you, folks. So you've had the political crap. Now shut up and dance.
All the Rage with John Bowd. On www.traxfm.org.